In April, White had set a new speed record of Mach 4.62, which was just over 3,000 miles an hour. And in May, Joe Walker had topped that by going Mach 4.95. And White had come right back in June and flown Mach 5.27. The X-15 now had the big engine, the XLR-99, with its 57,000 pounds of thrust. The True brothers were ready to go all out toward their goal of exceeding Mach 6 at an altitude of more than 50 miles in piloted flight. Piloted. These developments could be found in the press if one cared to look for them, but they were obscured by Gagarin's flight, followed by Shepard's flight, the single combat for the heavens. As a matter of fact, Joe Walker had taken the X-15 to Mach 4.95, the highest speed in the history of aviation, on the same day that Kennedy addressed Congress to propose the race for the moon. Next to the notion of a moon voyage, Walker's Mach 4.95 was pretty pedestrian stuff. But surely the truth would dawn on them eventually. It was with that in mind, the simple truth, that Joe Walker happened to run into Gus Grissom at the Holiday Inn's cocktail lounge. Both Gus and Joe had knocked back a few, it being after dark, after all, and Joe starts in with a little Jaeger-style country boy banter about how Gus and his pals had better hurry up or him and his boys would pass them on the way up. "Oh, yes," says Gus. "How's that?" "Well," says Joe Walker, "we've got a 57,000-pound rocket engine now, and the Redstone that shoots your little pea pod up there only puts out 78,000, so we're almost up with you. And we fly the damn thing. We actually fly it, and we land it." Joe Walker meant to keep it tight and just rag Grissom a little bit, but he couldn't hold back a note in his voice concerning where things actually stood in the true scheme of things, on the real pyramid of flying competition. Everybody is looking at Grissom, the astronaut, to see what he's going to say. Grissom, who is a tough little nut when he wants to be, stares at Walker, and then he breaks into a grin and starts a kind of gruff Gus chuckle. "Oh, I'll be looking over my shoulder the whole time, Joe. And if you come by, I swear, I'll wave." And so much for Joe Walker and the True brothers. It was all right there in that scene, the new simple truth. Grissom didn't even feel angry. There was nothing that Joe Walker could say or do, and nothing that even Chuck Yeager himself could say or do that would change the new order. The astronaut was now at the apex of the pyramid. The rocket pilots were already the old guys, the eternal remember wins. Oh, it didn't even have to be said. It was in the air, and everyone knew it. Hell, when they started flying jets and rocket planes at Muroc, somewhere there must have been the old guys, the bitter old bastards, the remember wins, who could just fly the hell out of a propeller plane, and were still insisting that this was what it was all about. Flying wasn't a competition like baseball or football. No, in flying, any major advance in technology could change the rules. The Mercury rocket capsule system, the word system, was now on everybody's lips, was the new cutting edge. No, Gus had no need to get excited any more over Joe Walker or anybody else at Edwards. Gus seemed like a pretty relaxed man all the way around. He would get a little irritated at the engineering sessions he sat in on during the last couple of weeks before the flight and would give them a few Gus gruff growls if they seemed to want to tinker with this and that at the last minute. But that seemed to be sheer eagerness to get on with the flight. There was even a bit of the old Boondock Edwards broomstick and baling wire spirit about the whole thing. Just two nights before the flight, it dawned on one of the doctors that they had never made provisions for a urine receptacle for Gus, to avoid the sort of thing Shepard had experienced. That was a hell of a note. They figured they could make do with an ordinary rubber condom for the receptacle. But what would hold it in place and keep it from coming off? Dee O'Hara, the nurse, helped out. She drove into Cocoa Beach and bought a panty girdle, and they rigged that up with a condom. The goddamn girdle gave you a hell of a tight grip on the groin, but Gus figured he could get by with it. All in all, he seemed pretty loose. a test pilot of the old school. He even had a foretaste of the mental atmosphere of the real thing, just as Shepard had. On July 19th, he was inserted into the capsule, and the hatch was sealed when the flight was canceled because of bad weather. The flight finally took place on July 21st. Judging by his pulse rate and respiration, which were transmitted via his body sensors, Gus was more nervous than Shepard during the countdown. These rates, taken by themselves, didn't mean a great deal, however, and no one would have thought twice about it except for what happened at the end of the flight. The flight itself was very nearly a duplicate of Shepard's, except that Grissom's capsule had a window, not just a periscope, giving him a much better view of the world, and he had a more sophisticated hand controller. His pulse stayed up around 150 throughout the 5 minutes he was weightless. Shepard's pulse had never reached 140, not even during the liftoff, and went up to 171 during the firing of the retro rockets before the re-entry through the Earth's atmosphere. The informal consensus among the program's doctors was that if an astronaut's pulse rate went above 180, the mission should be aborted. The capsule splashed down almost precisely on target, just as Shepard's had, within 3 miles of the recovery ship, the carrier Randolph. The capsule hit the water, then keeled over onto one side, just as Shepard's had, and took its own sweet time righting itself. Grissom thought he heard a gurgling noise inside the capsule, as had Shepard, and began looking for water seeping in, but didn't see any. The recovery helicopter, designated Hunt Club 1, was over the capsule within less than 2 minutes. Grissom was still in his seat, resting on his back, as he had been at the outset of the flight, and the capsule was bobbing around in the water. Over his microphone, Grissom said, "Okay, give me how much longer it'll be before you get her." The helicopter pilot, a Navy lieutenant named James Lewis, said, "This is Hunt Club 1. We are in orbit now at this time around the capsule." Grissom said, "Roger. Give me another 5 minutes here to mark these switch positions here before I give you a call to come in and hook on. Are you ready to come in and hook on at any time?" Lewis said, "Hunt Club 1, Roger. We are ready anytime you are." There was a chart on which the astronaut was supposed to record the switch positions on or off with a grease pencil. 5.5 minutes later, Grissom radioed Lewis in the helicopter again. "Okay, Hunt Club, this is Liberty Bell. Are you ready for the pickup?" Lewis said, "This is Hunt Club 1. This is affirmative." Grissom said, "Okay, latch on, then give me a call, and I'll power down and blow the hatch, okay?" "This is Hunt Club 1. Roger, we'll give you a call when we're ready for you to blow." Grissom said, "Roger, I've unplugged my suit, so I'm kind of warm now." Lewis said, "One Roger. One Roger. Now, if you tell me to, you're ready for me to blow, I'll have to take my helmet off, power down, and then blow the hatch." "One Roger, and when you blow the hatch, the collar will already be down there waiting for you, and we're turning base at this time." Roger. As the helicopter pilot, Lewis, looked down on the capsule, it shaped up as a routine retrieval, such as he and his co-pilot, Lieutenant John Raynard, had practiced many times. Raynard had a pole with a hook on it, like a shepherd's crook, that he was going to slip through a loop at the neck of the capsule. The crook was attached to a cable. The helicopter could hoist up to 4,000 pounds in this fashion. The capsule weighed about 2,400 pounds. Lewis had swung out and was making a low pass toward the capsule when suddenly he saw the capsule's side hatch go flying off into the water. But Grissom wasn't supposed to blow the hatch until he told him he had hooked on. And Grissom, there was Grissom, scrambling out of the hatch and plopping into the water without even looking up at him. Grissom was swimming like mad. Water was pouring into the capsule through the hatch, and the damn thing was sinking. Lewis wasn't worried about Grissom because he had practiced water egress with the astronauts many times, and he knew the pressure suits were more buoyant than any life preserver. They even seemed to enjoy playing around in the water in the suits. So he gunned the helicopter down to the level of the water to try to snare the capsule. By now, only the neck of the thing is visible above the water. Reinhardt goes to work with a shepherd's crook, leaning out of the helicopter, desperately trying to hook on. He finally hooks on as the capsule disappears under the water and starts sinking like a brick. Lewis is now down so low, all three wheels of the helicopter are in the water. The helicopter is like a fat man squatting over a tree stump trying to pull it out of the ground. Full of water as it is, the capsule weighs 5,000 pounds, 1,000 over the helicopter's capacity. Lewis already had a red light warning of impending engine failure, so he signals for a second helicopter, which is already nearby, to pick up Grissom. He finally pulls the capsule out of the water, but he can't make the helicopter move forward toward the carrier. He's just hanging there in the air like a hummingbird. Red lights are lighting up all over the panel. He's about to lose the ship as well as the capsule, so he cuts the capsule loose. It drops and disappears forever. The water is 3 miles deep at that point. They turn away finally. Grissom is still in the water. He's waving. He seems to be saying, "I'm okay." The second helicopter is moving in to lower the horse collar. In fact, Gus's waves were saying, "I'm drowning, you bastards, I'm drowning." As soon as Gus scrambled out of the hatch, he had begun swimming for his life. The goddamn capsule's going under. His suit caught momentarily on some sort of strap outside the capsule, probably leading to the dye canister. It was like a parachute. It would pull him under. He'd drown. The drowning man. No question about it. By this point, he was neither an astronaut nor a pilot. He was the drowning man. Get away from the death capsule, that was the idea. Then he calmed down a little. He was swimming around in the ocean under the roar of the helicopter blades. He wasn't sinking, after all. The pressure suit kept him bobbing in the water as high as his armpits. He looked up. The horse collar was hanging out of the helicopter. The horse collar that gets him out of this. But they were pulling away from him. They were going to the capsule. He could see the man named Reinhardt leaning out of the helicopter trying to snag the loop of the capsule. Only the neck of the capsule was out of the water. He started swimming back to the capsule. It was hard swimming in the pressure suit, but it kept him up. He bobbed right up to his armpits when he stopped swimming. Little swells kept breaking over his head, and he swallowed some water. He felt out of control. He was floundering around in the middle of the ocean. He looked up again, and there was another helicopter. He kept waving and waving, but nobody seemed to pay any attention. And now he wasn't bobbing up so high anymore. The pressure suit was losing its buoyancy. It was getting heavier, starting to drag him down. The suit had a rubber diaphragm that rolled up around his neck like a turtleneck sweater to keep the water from seeping down inside the suit. It didn't fit tight enough. Air was escaping. No, it was the oxygen inlet valve. He had completely forgotten. The valve allowed oxygen into his suit while he was in flight. He had unhooked the tube but forgotten to close the valve. The oxygen was bubbling out down there somewhere. The suit was becoming dead weight, pulling him down. He reached down and closed the valve underwater. But now his head kept going under, and he had to fight to get to the surface, and then the swells broke over his head, and he swallowed more water, and he'd look up at the helicopters and wave, and they just waved back. The bastards? How could they not know? In the window of one of the helicopters was a man with a camera, merrily taking pictures of him. They were waving and taking snapshots, the stupid bastards. They were going crazy over the goddamn capsule, and he was drowning before their very eyes. He kept going under. He'd fight his way back up and swallow some more water and wave. But that drove him back under. The suit, he seemed to be packed in 200 pounds of wet clay. The dimes and all that other shit. Christ, the dimes and those goddamn trinkets down there in his knee pocket. He'd had the bright idea of carrying 100 $1 bills on the flight as souvenirs, but he didn't have a spare $100 to his name. So he decided on 2 rolls of 50 dimes each, and he had put in 3 $1 bills for good measure and a whole bunch of little models of the capsule. And now this big junk heap of travel sentiment stuffed in his knee pocket was taking him under. Dimes. Silver dead weight. Deke, Where was Deke? Surely Deke would be here. He had done as much for Deke. Somehow Deke would materialize and save him. Deke and Wally and him had been down at Pensacola practicing water egress, and somehow Deke, in his whole pressure suit with his helmet on, had fallen off his raft and was going under it and couldn't do a goddamn thing about it. But he and Wally had been nearby with their swimming flippers on, and they had swum straight to him and held him up until one of the Navy swabos could reach them with a raft. And so it was no sweat, because they had been by his side, and surely Deke, or somebody, Deke... Cox, that face, up there, it's Cox. Deke wasn't here and wasn't going to be here, but Cox, whom he hardly knew, was his sole redeemer now. Cox was a Navy man in the second helicopter. Gus knew that face. Cox wasn't a stupid bastard. Cox had picked up Al Shepard. Cox had picked up the goddamn chimpanzee. Cox knew how to get people out of here. Cox. He could see Cox leaning out of the helicopter, lowering the horse collar. There was a hell of a roar everywhere from the two helicopters, but Cox, and his helicopter were just suspended there. They weren't coming any closer, and Gus's head kept going under. The wash from the helicopter propellers was driving him back. The closer his redeemer came in the helicopter, the farther he was driven back. The sharks, they can smell panic, and he was sheer panic. 160 pounds of it, plus 100 pounds of death dimes. Lost at last at 2,800 fathoms in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. But helicopters can drive off sharks with their prop wash. Cox would rout the shark and save him. But Cox got no closer, even though the horse collar was now touching the water. He was still about 90 feet away across the billows. Now he could see it, now he couldn't. The swells kept washing over him, but it was the only thing left. He swam for it. He couldn't get his legs to come up, so he fought toward the horse collar with his arms. He had no strength left. Everything pulled him down. He couldn't get enough breath. There was nothing but furious noise, blazing water. The water kept coming in his mouth. He would never make it. But the horse collar, Cox was up there. There was the horse collar. It was in front of him. He grabbed it and hung on. He was supposed to sit in it as if he were sitting on a swing. To hell with that. He flopped through the hole like a dead flounder landing on the fish market scales. He hung on with his arms. He felt as if he weighed a ton. The suit was full of water, and it had already dawned on him. I lost the capsule. As soon as Cox and his co-pilot pulled Grissom up into the helicopter, they could see that he was in a bad way. He looked funny. He was gasping for breath, and he was shaking. His eyes kept darting around. He found what he was looking for, a Mae West, a life preserver. He grabbed it and started trying to strap it on. He was having a hell of a time with it because he was shaking so. His arms would fly one way and the straps would fly the other. The engines made a terrific noise. They were heading back to the carrier. Grissom was still struggling with the straps. He obviously thought they were going to crash at any moment. He thought he was going to drown. He gasped. He battled the Mae West all the way back to the carrier. What the hell had happened to the man? First he had blown the hatch before the lead helicopter could hook on, and then he had floundered around out in the ocean, and now he was preparing to abandon ship in a goddamn helicopter on a perfectly calm sunny morning out near Bermuda? Once they got over the carrier Randolph, Grissom calmed down a bit. The same sort of awed faces that had welcomed Alan Shepard were craning up at the helicopter, but Grissom hardly noticed them. His head was in a very dark cloud. When he went below deck, he was still shaking. He kept saying, "I didn't do anything. The damn thing just blew." Within an hour, they had started the preliminary debriefing, and Grissom kept saying, "I didn't do anything. I was just lying there, and it just blew." A couple of hours later, at the formal debriefing on Grand Bahama Island, Grissom was much calmer. Although he looked exhausted and drawn, he was grim. He was a very unhappy man. His pulse was still up to 90. Normally at rest, it was 68 or 69. He kept saying, "I didn't touch it. I was just lying there, and it blew." According to Gus, here was what happened. Once he knew the helicopters were nearby, he felt secure in the capsule and therefore asked for 5 minutes to finish getting unhooked and record his switch positions. While the capsule was still descending under the parachute, he had opened his faceplate and disconnected the visor seal hose. Once the capsule was in the water, he disconnected the oxygen hose to his helmet, unfastened the helmet from the pressure suit, undid his chest strap, lap belt, shoulder harness, and knee straps, disconnected the wire leading to the biomedical sensors, and rolled the rubber neck dam up around his neck. His pressure suit was still attached to the capsule by the oxygen inlet hose, which he needed for cooling the suit, and his helmet still had its radio wiring leads hooked up. But all he had to do was take the helmet off, and he would be free of the wires. Then, all in keeping with the checklist, he removed the emergency knife that was clamped onto the hatch and put it in the survival kit, which was a canvas bag about 2 feet long, containing an inflatable life raft, shark repellent, a desalinization rig, food, a signal light, and so on. Before leaving the capsule via the hatch, as Gus recounted it, he had one more chore to perform. He was supposed to take out a chart and a grease pencil and mark the positions of all the switches on the instrument panel. Since he still had on his pressure suit gloves, making it hard to grip the grease pencil, this took him 3 or 4 minutes. Then he armed the explosive hatch by removing the cover from the detonator, which was a button about 3 inches in diameter, and removed the safety pin, which was like the safety catch on a revolver. Once the cover and pin were removed, 5 pounds of pressure on the detonator button would blow the bolts and propel the hatch out into the water. Now he radioed Lewis in the helicopter to come in and hook on. He unhooked the oxygen hose to his pressure suit and settled back on the seat and waited for Lewis to tell him he had hooked onto the capsule. Once he got the word from Lewis, he would blow the hatch. While he was lying there, he said, he started wondering if there was some way he could retrieve the knife from the survival kit before he blew the hatch and left the capsule. He figured it would make a terrific souvenir. This thought was running idly through his mind, he said, when he heard a dull thud. He knew immediately that it was the hatch blowing. In the next instant, he was looking straight out the hatchway at the brilliant blue sky over the ocean, and water was pouring in. There was not even time to grapple for the survival kit. He took his helmet off and grabbed the right side of the instrument panel and thrust his head through the hatchway and wriggled out. I had the cap off and the safety pin out, Gus said, but I don't think that I hit the button. The capsule was rocking around a little, but there weren't any loose items in the capsule, so I don't see how I could have hit it. But possibly I did. As the day wore on and the formal debriefing got underway, Gus discounted even the possibility that he had hit the button. I was lying there, flat on my back, and it just blew. Nobody was about to accuse Gus of anything, but the engineers kept rolling their eyes at each other. The explosive hatch was new to the Mercury capsule, but explosive hatches had been in use on jet fighters since the early 1950s. When a pilot pulled his cinch ring and ejected, the hatch blew and a TNT charge rocketed the pilot and his seat parachute rig through the opening. The pilot and anyone who might be riding back seat routinely armed their hatches and the TNT charges out on the runway before takeoff. This was the equivalent of Gus's removing the detonator cover and the safety pin. Of course, any apparatus rigged up with explosive charges had the potential of exploding at the wrong time. Later on, NASA put a hatch assembly through every test the engineers could dream up to try to make the hatch blow without hitting the detonator button. They subjected it to trial by water, trial by heat. They shook it, pounded it, dropped it on concrete from a height of 100 feet, and it never just blew. There were many conjectures uttered very quietly, very privately. And at Edwards, the True Brothers, well, my God, as you can imagine, they were laughing. Naturally, they couldn't say anything. But now, surely it was so obvious, Grissom had just screwed the pooch. In flight test, if you did something that stupid, if you destroyed a major prototype through some lame brain mistake such as hitting the wrong button, you were through. You'd be lucky to end up in flight engineering. Oh, it was obvious to everybody at Edwards that Grissom had just fucked it. Screwed the pooch, that was all. It was doubtful that he had hit the detonator on purpose, because even if he were feeling a little panicky in the water, you have to be afraid to panic, old buddy. He wasn't likely to ask for trouble by blowing the hatch before the helicopter hooked on and was overhead with a horse collar. But if a man is beginning to panic, logic goes first. Maybe the poor bastard just wanted out, and bango, he punched the button. But what about the business of the knife? He said he wanted to take the knife as a souvenir. So he may have been trying to fish the knife out of the survival kit. The capsule is rocking in the swells. He bangs into the detonator, and that's all it would have taken. Oh, there was no question that he had hit the damn button some way. The only thing they liked about his entire performance was the way he said, "I was just lying there, and it just blew," and the way he stuck to it. There, Gus, old boy, you showed the instincts of a true fighter jock. Oh, you learned many of the lessons well. After you've done some forbidden hassling and your ship flames out and you have to eject and your F-100 goes kaboom on the desert floor, naturally, you come back to the base and say, "I don't know what happened, sir. It just flamed out on me. I was minding my own business. The demons did it." And go easy on the details. A broad stroke of vagueness. That's the ticket. "I was lying there, and it just blew." Oh, that was rich. And then the brethren sat back and waited for the Mercury astronaut to get his, the way any one of them would have gotten his had a comparable fuck-up occurred at Edwards. And nothing happened. From first to last, the publicity that came out of NASA, out of the White House, from wherever, told of what a severe disappointment it had been to brave little Gus to lose the capsule through a malfunction after so successful a flight. Little Gus, he became. The sympathy that welled up was terrific. Only 5'6" with a round face, it was amazing that so much courage could be packed into 66 inches, and we almost lost him through drowning. The true brothers were incredulous. The Mercury astronauts had an official immunity to 3/4 of the things by which test pilots were ordinarily judged. They were by now ablaze with the superstitious aura of the single combat warrior. They were the heroes of Kennedy's political comeback, the updated new frontier whose symbol was a voyage to the moon. To announce that the second one, Gus Grissom, had prayed to the Lord, "Please, dear Lord, don't let me fuck up," but that his prayer had not been answered, and the Lord let him screw the pooch. Well, this was an interpretation of that event that was to be avoided at all cost. NASA was no more anxious to have to call Grissom on the carpet than Kennedy was. NASA had just been handed a carte blanche for a moon project. Just 6 months before, the organization had been in live danger of losing the space program altogether. So nothing about this flight was going to be called a failure. It was possible to argue that Grissom's flight had been a great success. There had been a small problem immediately afterward. As for public opinion, the loss of the capsule didn't really matter very much. The fact that the engineers needed the capsule to study the effects of heat and stress and to retrieve various types of automatically recorded data, this certainly created no national gloom. Get the man up and bring him down alive. That, not engineering, was at the heart of the single combat. So the possibility that Gus might have blundered was never brought up again. Far from having a tarnished record, he was a hero. He had endured and overcome so much. He was back solidly in the rotation for whatever great flights might come up in the future, as if by magic. In the days after the flight, Gus looked gloomier and gruffer than ever. He could manage an official smile when he had to, and an official hero's wave, but the black cloud would not pass. Betty Grissom looked the same way after she and the two boys, Mark and Scott, joined Gus in Florida for the celebration. Some celebration. It was as if the event had been poisoned by the Gus grim little secret. Betty also had the sneaking suspicion that everyone was saying, just out of earshot, Gus blew it. But her displeasure was a bit more subtle than Gus's. They, NASA, the White House, the Air Force, the other fellows, Gus himself, were not keeping their side of the compact. Nobody could have looked at Betty at that time, this pretty, shy, ever silent, ever proper, honorable Mrs. Astronaut, and guessed at her anger. They were violating the military wife's compact. By now, Betty knew what to expect from Gus personally, which is to say she seldom saw him. In one 365-day period, he had been with her a total of 60 days. About 6 months before, Betty had to go into the hospital near Langley for exploratory surgery. There was a good chance she would require a hysterectomy. Betty had a real siege in the hospital. She was there 21 days. She was there for so long she had to get some of her relatives to fly in from Indiana to look after the boys. Gus managed to see her in the hospital exactly once, and he didn't quite make it through the entire visiting hour. He got a call right there in the hospital asking him to return to the base, and he left. Betty seldom speculated, even to herself, on what Gus did during the 80% of the year that he was not with her. She had worked that out in her mind. The compact took care of it. If Gus was occasionally the complete fighter jock away from home, that did not violate the compact. And now it was time for the other part of the compact to take effect. It was her time to be the Honorable Mrs. Captain, Second American in Space. They owed her every bit of it. Louise Shepard over in Virginia Beach hadn't known what was going to happen when Al went up, so her place was invaded by reporters and sightseers. They practically tore the yard to pieces just by milling around and tramping through the shrubbery to press their noses up against the window. Gus was not having any of that. Gus saw to it that the local police were out patrolling in front of the house early in the morning before dawn. Betty was inside the house in front of the TV set with Renee Carpenter, Joe Shirah, Marge Slayton, the children. Outside slavered the animal. There were a lot of reporters on the sidewalk and back in the driveway of the house next door, but the palace guard kept them all under control. Betty actually felt pretty good. It was the danger wake business again. She was the hostess and star of the drama. She almost missed the final countdown. She was in the kitchen turning off the flame under some soft-boiled eggs for somebody. After the flight, all sorts of neighbors and NASA people at Langley came rushing in, congratulating her and bringing more food and making a fuss over her. But Betty knew enough about flight tests to know that the loss of the capsule could have some grim results. A call came in from Gus on Grand Bahama Island. There were a lot of people still in the house, but she had to ask the question anyway. You didn't do anything wrong, did you?
I did not do anything wrong, he said very slowly. You could almost see the black Gus gruff look over the telephone. That hatch just blew. I'm glad.
She started telling him about all the people who were telephoning congratulations.
That's good, said Gus. Say, by the way, the motel lost two pairs of my slacks in the laundry, and I need shirts. Will you bring me some when you come down to the Cape?
The laundry? He wanted her to remember to bring the laundry. Betty and the boys arrived at the Cape on one of those blinding hot July days that made all of Cocoa Beach feel like a fried concrete parking lot. They were let out to a runway at Patrick Air Force Base, along with a lot of NASA and military dignitaries to meet Gus's plane as it came in from Grand Bahama Island. There was a big canopy set up nearby. Under the canopy, there would be a press conference. Betty stood out there on the slab with James Webb and some other NASA brass, and she slowly began to realize that they were reneging. This was going to be it. A reception out on this brain-frying slab. This was going to be no trip to the White House. Webb,
not John Kennedy, was going to give Gus the Distinguished Service Medal under a dreadful low-rent tent here on the slab. There was going to be no parade in Washington, no ticker tape parade in New York, not even a parade in Mitchell, Indiana. That Betty would have loved. To come back to Mitchell and parade down Main Street. But Gus would be getting nothing. Just a medal from James E. Webb. They couldn't do this to her. They were reneging. But they did. And it was even worse than she feared. The plane comes in, taxis up to the ramp. A big cheer goes up. Gus steps out, and some NASA functionaries take her and her children by the elbows and thrust them forward at Gus like religious objects. Behold, the wife, the children, and Gus can hardly even look at Betty as someone he knows. She's merely the ceremonial, solid backing on the home front, trundled forward on the concrete slab. Gus mutters hello, hugs the two boys, and they trundle the wife and the children back. And then Gus is marched over to the canopy where they have the press conference. The reporters keep harping on the blown hatch and the lost capsule. The dismal bastards, they haven't gotten the message yet. They haven't picked up the proper moral tone. But being part of the great colonial animal, the Victorian gent, they would get it all straight in a few days and never mention the damnable hatch again. But for now, they gave the event another shot of the poisonous secret. Was that what was responsible for this wretched, shabby, mean little ceremony? Gus struggled with the questions and sweated under the canopy. He kept saying, I was just lying there minding my own business when the hatch blew. It just blew. Betty could see he was getting angrier and angrier, gruffer and grimmer and darker about the eyes. He hated talking to reporters as it was. Her heart went out. They were making him squirm. And this was the big parade. This was what she got out of the compact after all this. It was a travesty. She was the Honorable Mrs. Squirming Hatchblower. The day only got hotter. After the little ceremony with Webb waxing sonorous, they drove Gus and Betty and the boys to the VIP guest house at Patrick Air Force Base. This was supposed to be a big deal. They were told that these were secret quarters where they would be completely screened off from the press and the gawkers. The VIP guest house. Betty looked around. Even the military VIP quarters here at Cocoa Beach were low rent. This VIP guest house was like some musty cabin court from the late 1930s. She looked out the window. Over there was the beach, that amazing hot brick Cocoa Beach. But between the guest house and the beach was Route A1A, with cars roaring back and forth in the screaming heat of mid-July. She would never even make it across the highway to the beach with the children. Well, they could watch TV, but there was no TV. And no pool. Then she looked in the kitchen and opened the refrigerator. It was stuffed with food, everything you could imagine. For some reason, this made her furious. She could see the afternoon shaping up and the rest of the day and tomorrow, too. She would stay here with the children, cooking and risking her life, dragging them to the worst beach in Florida, and Gus would no doubt go to the Space Center or into town. Town meant the Holiday Inn, where the other fellows and their wives would be. That's where they would be celebrating and having the good times.
Listen, while you're getting settled,
Suddenly, Betty was furious. She was not staying in this place. Gus didn't know what had gotten into her. She said she wanted to go to the Holiday Inn. That was where everybody would be. She told Gus to call the Holiday Inn and get a room. She gruffed it out with such fury that Gus called the Holiday Inn and pulled the strings and got them a room. If Gus managed to park her here in this faded VIP mausoleum and vanish, so that she could sit here in the heat of the slab, watching the hours go by while he tooled around the pool at the Holiday as the big shot, she would have slit a wrist. So that's how grim it was. That was how shabbily they had treated her. That was how grossly they had welched on the compact. Now, they truly owed her. Chapter 12. the tears. Since the Pooch proved to be unscrewable officially and Gus's flight was therefore on the record as a success, NASA was suddenly in great shape. John Kennedy was happy. We have started our long voyage to the moon. That was the idea. Neither Shepard's nor Grissom's suborbital flight measured up to Yuri Gagarin's orbit of the Earth, but the fact that NASA had completed two successful manned flights seemed to mean that the United States was battling back successfully in the competition for the heavens. Naturally, true to form, that was the moment the anonymous and uncanny chief designer D-503, builder of the Integral, chose to show the world who actually ruled the heavens. Just 16 days after Grissom's flight, which is to say on August 6, 1961, the Soviets sent Vostok 2 into orbit with a cosmonaut named German Titov aboard. Titov circled the Earth for an entire day, completing 17 full orbits and landing where he started, on Soviet soil. Three times he came over the United States, 125 miles overhead. Once again, all over the country, politicians and press seemed profoundly alarmed, and the awful vision was presented. Suppose the cosmonaut were armed with hydrogen bombs and flung them as he came over, like Thor flinging thunderbolts, one here, one there. Toledo disappears off the face of the Earth, Kansas City, Lubbock. Titov's flight seemed so awesome it made the Shepard and Grissom flights look terribly insignificant. The Integral and its chief designer could apparently do anything they wanted and at any time. 7 days later, August 13th, 1961, Nikita Khrushchev began the steps that led to the building of a wall, precisely like a penitentiary wall, through the middle of an entire city, Berlin, to prevent the population of East Berlin from crossing over to the West. But the world was still blinking at the radiance of the day-long space flight. They're a bit brutal, but you have to admit, they're geniuses. Imagine keeping a man in space for 24 hours. So far as NASA was concerned, the Titov flight put an end to the Mercury Redstone program then and there. The next astronaut in line to ride on top of the Redstone, John Glenn, was now assigned to attempt an orbital flight using the Atlas rocket, which had done so poorly in unmanned tests. Later, there were those who speculated that NASA had been saving Glenn for the big one all along. But Glenn did not have that kind of status within NASA. He had learned that to his bitter regret. No, he had only the invisible chief designer, builder of the Integral, to thank for the fact that he was assigned to be the first American to orbit the Earth. After Titov's flight, the phrase "the space gap" began to be repeated throughout the American press. Space gap was a superstitious condition. It began to seem of urgent importance for NASA to put a man into space before the sand stopped flowing in the hourglass on the last day of the year 1961. The great cowboy rush of the winter of 1960-61 started all over again. The hell with fastidious precautions. For example, the Soviets revealed that Titov had suffered from nausea throughout his flight. Later, they changed that to say he had suffered nausea after prolonged flight. They would have probably not revealed even that much, except that they decided to participate in international scientific conferences in order to publicize their space feats. It also came out, although few specifics were given, that the Soviet manned spaceflight program, from selection of their cosmonauts from among military pilots and their training, centrifuge rides, parabolic rides in jet fighters, and so forth, to capsule design and launching and retro rocket systems, was remarkably similar to NASA's. Everyone at NASA regarded this as vastly reassuring. We're on the right track, anyway. Of course, the Soviet rockets were far more powerful, that was a given. And if a cosmonaut of the Integral had suffered nausea in orbit, then astronauts probably would, too. But there was no time to worry about that now. Find out about it the way Titov did. Up there. Masala. Over the next hill. In September, NASA successfully launched a Mercury Atlas capsule with a dummy astronaut aboard and brought it back on target into the Atlantic near Bermuda after one orbit of the Earth. The press speculated that Kennedy would pressure NASA to put an astronaut on the next flight, but Hugh Dryden and Bob Gilruth managed to hold out for an additional test. They wanted to send a chimpanzee into orbit with the Atlas rocket first. This time out at Edwards, the True Brothers didn't even derive a chilly smile from the fact that once more in the exalted Project Mercury, an ape would be taking the first flight. An ape would make the first orbit of the Earth for the USA. The prestige of Project Mercury had by now rendered such considerations meaneless. On October 11, at Edwards, Bob White had made an extraordinary flight in the X-15, and the country hardly noticed. White took the X-15 up to 217,000 feet with the big engine, and the press merely nodded perfunctorily. So a man had just flown very high in an airplane. How interesting, and that was that. The fact that White was on top of a rocket, the same sort of rocket as the Redstone or the Atlas, the fact that his flight to 217,000 feet was in effect piloted spaceflight, none of this was likely to impress Kennedy or the public amid the panic over Titov and the space gap. White had gone 40 miles up, 10 miles short of the arbitrarily set boundary of space. The XLR-99, the big engine, had delivered 57,000 pounds of thrust, just 21,000 short of the thrust of the Redstone that took Shepard and Grissom aloft. White's speed reached Mach 5.21, or 3,647 miles an hour. Shepard's and Grissom's rocket velocities were only slightly higher, about 5,180 miles per hour. White was weightless for 3 minutes during his tremendous arc over the top, as compared to Shepard's and Grissom's 5 minutes. White saw all the things that Shepard and Grissom saw, and Shepard only barely, including the entire blue band of atmosphere at the horizon of the Earth. Above all, White was a pilot. He controlled his plane's ascent. He used hydrogen peroxide thrusters to control his attitude once the air became too thin for aileron control, the same system of hydrogen peroxide thrusters that Shepard and Grissom had used, and he did it all without benefit of any automatic backup. And he brought the ship back down through the Earth's atmosphere himself and landed it himself on the holy plateau of Edwards, on the Dome of the World. A rocket pilot, quoth the brethren, but the national press barely noticed. So, it was with a mainly academic fascination that the boys at Edwards followed the second Project Mercury chimpanzee flight. For 9 months, the veterinarians at Holloman Air Force Base had been putting their colony of chimpanzees through the operant conditioning regimen in preparation for an orbital flight. The training included all the things that had gone into the training of the first suborbital flight, the centrifuge runs, the weightless parabolas, the procedures trainer sessions, the heat chamber and altitude chamber sessions, plus some intelligence tests. In one test, the ape had to be able to judge time intervals. The signal light would go on, and he had to wait 20 seconds before pulling the lever, or he would receive the ever-cocked electrical shock. In another, the animal was required to read the instrument panel and throw a switch. Three symbols would flash on the panel, two of which would be identical, such as two triangles and one square. And the animal had to pull the lever under the odd one or receive the shock in the soles of the feet. By the beginning of November, 20 veterinarians had moved into Hangar S at the Cape with 5 chimpanzees. One of them was Ham, thinner and more strung out than ever, but still an ace in the procedures trainer, his life dedicated to the avoidance of the invisible volts. Ham was not regarded as the pick of the lot, however. The brightest and quickest member of the colony was a male who had been brought from Africa to Holloman Air Force Base in April of 1960, when he was about 2.5 years old. He was known as Number 85. Number 85 had fought the veterinarians and the process of operant conditioning like a Turkish prisoner of war. He fought them with his hands, his feet, his teeth, his saliva, and his cunning. He would shake off each jolt of electricity and give them a hideous grin. When he couldn't take the shocks anymore, he would cooperate temporarily, and his hands would fly across the procedures trainer console like e-power bigs at the organ, and then he would turn on the vets, making another desperate thrash toward freedom. He was like the slave who wouldn't break. Finally, they shut him up inside a metal box and let him thrash about in there for a week with his feces and urine for company. When they let him out, he was, at last, a different ape. He had had enough. He didn't want any more of the box. His operant conditioning could now begin in earnest. The box was certainly not the course that the good vets of Holloman would have chosen had the times been normal. No, they had chosen this course in the name of the battle for the heavens and under the pressure of national urgency. Number 85 was the ape that the MA-5 mission, the fifth test of the Mercury Atlas vehicle, required. He was the quickest study in the universe of the Simia Satyrus. They took him up in jet fighters to get him used to the accelerations, the noise, and the disorienting sensations of high-speed flight. They put him in the gondola of the human centrifuge at the University of Southern California and ran him through entire profiles of the proposed first American orbital mission until he was used to the 7 or 8 G's he would experience on ascent or on reentry. Under high G's or low G's, Number 85 could operate a Mercury console like no ape that had ever lived. He was so good they used him as the test subject for a laboratory experiment that simulated a 14-day orbital mission. For 14 days, Number 85 was on the procedures trainer performing the same task he would perform in the 4.5-hour MA-5 mission. For MA-5, they had added rewards as well as the punishment of the shocks of the feet. Number 85 had two tubes positioned near his mouth. Out of one came banana-flavored pellets, if he did his task correctly, and from the other, he could take sips of water. Number 85 could do the task so handily, including reading the odd symbol panel, he could have kept the tubes popping banana pellets in water until he was sated or bilious. He was outstanding. By now, November of 1962, he had been through 1,263 hours of training, the equivalent of 158 8-hour days. For the equivalent of 43 days, he had been strapped in one simulator or conditioning apparatus or another, whether the centrifuge, the jets, or the procedures trainer. He was a marvel. The only problem was his blood pressure. Back in June of 1960, 2 months after his training began, they had put a blood pressure cuff on him and obtained a reading of from 140 to 160 systolic. This was certainly high, but it was hard to tell with Number 85. He had fought every medical examination as if it were an assault. It took 2 or 3 people just to restrain him. 3 months later, they were getting readings from 140 to 210. By now, they were running from 190 to 210. The blood pressures of all 5 chimpanzees out back of Hangar S had mounted steadily over the past 2 years, although none was so elevated as Number 85's. Well, maybe it was the pressure cuff, which he didn't see very often and which probably struck him as a big black restraining mechanism. After all, Number 85 was excitable. Perhaps they would find out more during the flight. There had been no way of reading the blood pressure of the other ape, Number 61, during his Mercury Redstone flight, but for this one, they put catheters in a main artery and a main vein of Number 85's legs to provide pressure readings before the launch and throughout the flight. They also put a catheter in his urethra to collect urine. Number 85 went through procedure trainer drills out in the vans behind Hangar S right up to the eve of the flight. He was still the pick of the litter. He must have been wound up tighter than a window shade spring, judging by the systolic readings. Just before the flight, his name was announced to the press as Enos, Enos meant man in Hebrew. The flight did not attract much interest. The public, like the president, was impatient with the test, especially since it was already November 29 when the ape was launched, and it was becoming clear that there would be no manned launch before the year was over. The year would end without a manned flight. Number 85 was supposed to make three orbits of the Earth. The launch went perfectly, with number 85 pulling his levers a mile a minute. The Atlas rocket delivered 367,000 pounds of thrust, nearly five times what Shepard and Grissom had experienced, but neither the noise nor the vibrations fazed number 85 in the slightest. He had heard and felt worse in the centrifuge runs with their piped-in sound. And since he had no window, he did not know where he was leaving the Earth, and for that matter, the noise, the vibrations, or departure from this globe was preferable to the box. He kept working his levers as fast as they could light up the panel. The capsule went into a perfect orbit. Throughout the first orbit, number 85 performed like a dream, not only hitting the levers on cue and in complicated sequences, but also taking six-minute rest periods when signaled to, or at least lying motionless, the better to avoid the juice. During the second orbit, the wiring went haywire. When number 85 did the odd symbol exercise, he started getting electrical shocks in his left foot even when he pulled the correct lever. He kept pulling the correct levers. Nonetheless, he was unstoppable. His suit started overheating. He didn't even slow down. Now the automatic attitude controls began malfunctioning, so that the capsule kept rolling over 45 degrees before the thrusters on either side would correct it. It kept rolling back and forth. Didn't throw number 85 out of his routine for a second. He kept reading the lights and flipping the levers. It would have to get a whole lot worse than this before it was as bad as the box. Because the rolling was using up too much hydrogen peroxide, they had to be sure there was enough left to position the capsule correctly, blunt end down, for re-entry. They brought the capsule down after two orbits into the Pacific off Point Arguello, California. Number 85 bobbed around, and the capsule bobbed around in the ocean for an hour and 15 minutes before a ship arrived to retrieve them. The capsule had an explosive hatch, but it did not just blow, nor had number 85 thrown up, like Titov, because of weightlessness or erratic motion. He had been weightless for a full 3 hours during the flight. He was calm when they removed him from the capsule. There was evidence, however, that he had had a merry old time for himself out there in the water. He hadn't just cooled his heels. The little bastard had ripped through the belly panel of his restraint suit and removed most of the biomedical sensors from his body and damaged the rest, including those that had been inserted under his skin. He had yanked the urinary catheter out of his penis. To just pull it out like that must have hurt like hell. What came over him? The flight had been a great success, all things considered, but one thing bothered the NASA life sciences people. The animal's blood pressure had been badly elevated. It had run from 160 to 200 throughout, even when his pulse rate was normal and he was watching his lights and pulling his levers with great efficiency. Was this some sort of morbid and unforeseen effect of prolonged weightlessness? Were astronauts in Earth orbit going to be candidates for apoplexy? The Holloman veterinarians hastened to reassure them that number 85, Enos, had registered high blood pressure readings for 2 years now. It seemed to be the nature of the beast. The NASA folk nodded, although 200 systolic was awfully goddamn high. Privately, the situation had the Holloman scientists thinking, and not about spaceflight either. The readings they had gotten from number 85 in the past with the cuff may or may not have been reliable, but there was no mistaking the readings of the catheters during the flight and just before it. Once they were inserted, number 85 wasn't even aware of them. They were giving true readings. His blood pressure had not gone up because of the stresses of the flight. He took the flight with utmost aplomb. His heart and respiratory rates and body temperatures were actually below the readings obtained during the centrifuge runs. In fact, his blood pressure had not gone up at all. It had been up there all along. A theory with implications for men on Earth, not men in space, was beginning to form. Number 85, smartest of the Simia Satyrus, prince of the lower primates, had swallowed so much rage over the past 2 years, thanks to the operant conditioning process, it had begun pumping out through his arteries,